Welcome, everyone, to the study for today, April 23rd, 2024, of the Common Era. The time is 1926 hours Eastern Daylight Time. Ward Green with you again. Today, the Crucible of Credible Creed, Part 2, is what we're studying, Chapter 10 this time, Paragraph 11 for today. Brothers, let us not be using the world to the full, since the scene of the world belies its continual state of flux. That is a translation by me of 1 Corinthians 7:31, which reads, let those making use of the world be as those not using it to the full, for the scene of this world is changing. From the reference version of the New World Translation, 1 Corinthians chapter 7, verse 31. Our proverb for today, we should do that before I forget. Let's do that. The proverb for today is from Proverbs 15, verses 29 and 30. I thought that was, yeah. We are approaching the end of this chapter, but I thought we were even closer. Let me verify where we are here. The chapter and verse number. 27, 28 from yesterday, it looks like. Yeah, so I think that's right. Should be able to do 29 and 30 today, little ones. This is the proverb for today. Jehovah is far from the wicked one's wrong. The prayer of the upright he hears like a song. The light of the eyes is refreshing the will. And good news is making the bones fatter still. Fatness of the bones is mentioned in the Bible. Making the bones fat is a good thing in the Bible, which is probably something that we know about from modern medicine as well, or modern science, I should say. We want to be careful about the word medicine because it seems to imply a lot of times the use of artificial substances, man-made substances. But bones fat, if we look that up in the Bible, the brightness of the eyes, Proverbs 15 and 30, that's what we just read, makes the heart rejoice. A report that is good makes the bones fat. That was the same thing that we just read, just in a different translation from the reference version of the New World Translation from 1984. We'll be doing Ezra chapter 9 today and Zechariah 13, both of which are the second last chapters in those books. So Jehovah willing, we'll be finishing those books, both of them, tomorrow. Now, the eclipse that we discovered at Babylon that was foretold, or afterwards, it wasn't foretold, it was determined by the statement of Sennacherib about 418 years later. It looks like this, the moon blocking the sun completely. It's a total eclipse at Babylon. We already showed the trace of it, its path across the landscape. How it passed right through Babylon, and that's what it looks like as a total eclipse at Babylon, May 18th, 1124. Now, we might be completing our Bible reading on May 17th this year, if we're continuing the way we are. The work of Mr. Peter J. Huber, lunar dates computed using the Planetary Lunar and Stellar Visibility 3.1.0, which is a program quite separate from Mr. Huber, plus the genealogy of the Hittite Empire, all seem to imply that year one of King Amisaduka of Babylon, the fourth king after Hammurabi, may be securely placed at 1702 BCE. That's according to Peter Huber. Provided only that the missing name on the Venus tablet may be Amisaduka. We are not affiliated in any way with any of such sources, and any similarity between beliefs is purely coincidental. Based on what we said earlier about the program PLSV and the Hittite Empire and its genealogy, we're not affiliated with those things, and we're not affiliated with Mr. Huber either. Having a reasonably good fit at 1702 BCE, we have found an even better fit to the date of the Venus tablet, and thus feel we must disagree with the beautiful fit at 1702. The best fit corresponds to the date 933 before Christ, as year one of the God-given Babylonian king Nabu-Apla-Edina. This agrees with the earliest known copies of the Venus tablet, which also have been found to date at earliest only to the rule of Assyrian king Sargon II, that is 720 BCE. The 213-year gap between 933 and 720 compares to a 982-year gap for the 1702 date. Thus, 933 BCE has an added advantage as being more contemporary. The king who sacked Babylon is not named in any source, so it might as well be any date and have been done by Moses. I'm being facetious there. To be kind, those who date the sack of Babylon to 1531 BCE have no foot, let alone a leg, to stand on, while they say that it must have been, in quotes, it must have been Mursili the First, or some such nonsense, resting all of ancient history on circumstantial evidence. Whilst investigating Venus tablet dates, we found a pair of eclipses located at 2021 BCE, lunar, then solar, in position to bring year one of Hammurabi, taking 2021 BCE for the last year of Samsu-Ditana, as high as, for Hammurabi, 2218 BCE, as in the following calculation. 2021 plus the difference between the date for Hammurabi year 1, which is 1725, according to even Oxford and some other well-known, the World Book Encyclopedia, many people date Hammurabi year 1, 1728, which is 64 years later than what Wikipedia dates it at the present time in the list of Babylonian kings, which we see here. Hammurabi 1792 is what how Wikipedia dates it. Dates Hammurabi year 1. So 64 years earlier. But we use the other sources, such as New World Encyclopedia, Hammurabi 1728, and Oxford reference, Hammurabi, about 1728. Okay, so they're still dating it that way, even though we wrote this article in 2012. Now, when we add 1728 minus 1531, which is the difference between the date that was conventionally given for the year one of Hammurabi and the sack of Babylon, those two dates taken as a difference, when we added that to the two eclipses we discovered in 2021 BCE, we obtained 2218 BCE for the year one of Hammurabi, as shown in that calculation. 2021 plus in brackets 1728 minus 1531 end bracket equals 2218 BCE. Given Naram Sin as Hammurabi, if we say that they're the same person, the 52 years that Eusebius gives to Ninus, giving Naram Sin, assuming he is Hammurabi, and giving him the 52 years that Eusebius gives to Ninus, in terms of his length of reign, his reign length, there were 42 years given in Wikipedia for his reign length. What did Oxford give him? 42, right. Same as what New World Encyclopedia. New World Encyclopedia. That was the other source. Not World Book. New World Encyclopedia. Okay. I'm not saying World Book doesn't give that date. They may well. But when we take the difference now of the 52 years from 2218, if we give the 52 years that Eusebius gave to Ninus, to Hammurabi, we get 2218 minus 52 equals 2166, which is exactly year one of Shark-Ali-Shari in our chronology. And Shark-Ali-Shari was the king who succeeded Naram-Sin, who we give 36 years or something like that, but other sources, there are conflicting sources for what the reign of Naram-Sin was. If we look at, he was given 56 years here in the Sumerian kings list. So obviously 52 is a reasonable number anyway, based on the uncertainties. So we arrived, and he was the one on the Sumerian kings list who preceded Shark-Ali-Shari, whose year one we've already dated by other means to 2166, using year one of Sargon as 2268, and year one of Sargon as 2302, with longer reign lengths in between. But 2166 is the year one of Shark-Ali-Shari, which is incredibly exactly in agreement with this calculation that we just did. So we're not really sure whether Hammurabi is or is not the same person as Naram-Sin, or we're just aware that there are so many uncertainties, very many uncertainties, in the ancient historians and the records obtained from them. So we're just trying everything and anything to see what we can come up with and see if anything agrees. That definitely agreed, and I didn't work hard at that to get that agreement. It just happened to fall out very easily. So I don't know why I did it. I don't have a clue, but I believe in Jehovah, and so therefore I have to give a credit to him for guiding me in doing that. It's a remarkable discovery, and it seems to say that, well, we've already established 2141 anyway as being the best, the most incredibly important date for the beginning of the Assyrian kingdom, which was led by Gudea or Chedorlaomer at its outset in 2141. In 2141, because that is in perfect alignment with the Book of Jasher and the Bible with regard to the chronology in the Septuagint, which gives us the date. Well, the Bible gives us the date for year one, or the birth of Abraham, as 2206 in the Septuagint, and the Book of Jasher gives us the battle in 2146, which is 5 years before the beginning of the kingdom of Assyria, led by Gudea. It's all perfect in this incredible, you know, blessing, or this miraculous preservation, I guess. It's the preservation of these numbers and these dates, and these dates that we obtain that are in agreement with the Bible. We have to adhere to the Bible more closely than all these other fluctuating and, you know, controversial dates given by ancient and modern historians. They're all in flux, and they're all at odds with each other, and they're in great disagreement. So the Bible gives us this clear path. It's so brilliantly bright compared to the others, even though there, many of them are, even the Bible is something that's, for many people, it's not that bright. Can't be clearly seen without some study, but it's much brighter than these other sources. So Ezra chapter 9. And as soon as these things were finished, the princes approached me, saying, the people of Israel and the priests and the Levites, that is, they got back to Jerusalem, all those things, they unpacked, you know, and prepared to do things at the temple. And the people of Israel and the priests, the princes said, and the Levites have not separated themselves from the peoples of the lands as regards their detestable things, namely the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Perizzites, the Jebusites, the Ammonites. I was going to say the Amorites, but they're going to be mentioned also. The Ammonites, the Moabites, the Egyptians, and the Amorites. The Canaanites, the Hittites, the Perizzites, the Jebusites, the Ammonites, the Moabites, the Egyptians, and the Amorites. The people of Israel and the priests and the Levites have not separated themselves from the peoples of the lands, specifically those ones just mentioned, for they have accepted some of their daughters for themselves and for their sons, and they, the holy seed, have become mingled with the peoples of the lands, and the hand of the princes and the deputy rulers has proved to be foremost in this unfaithfulness. Now, as soon as I heard of this thing, Ezra writes, I ripped apart my garment and my sleeveless coat, and I began to pull out some of the hair of my head and of my beard, and I kept sitting stunned. Also, to me, they came gathering themselves, everyone trembling because of the words of the God of Israel, against the unfaithfulness of the exiled people, while I was sitting stunned until the grain offering of the evening. And at the grain offering of the evening, I stood up from my humiliation with my garment and my sleeveless coat torn apart. And I proceeded to kneel upon my knees and spread out my palms to Jehovah my God. And I went on to say, O my God, I do feel ashamed and embarrassed to raise my face to you, O my God. For our errors themselves have multiplied over our head, and our guiltiness has grown great even to the heavens. From the days of our forefathers we have been in great guiltiness until this day. And because of our errors we have been given, we ourselves, our kings, our priests, into the hand of the kings of the lands, with the sword, with the captivity, and with the plunder, and with shame of face. Just as this day, and this day in this time, year 7 of Artaxerxes, after they'd returned from Babylon to Jerusalem, was the year 458 BCE in our chronology. And now for a little moment, favor from Yahweh our God has come by leaving over for us those who escape, and by giving us a peg in this holy place to make our eyes shine, O our God, and to give us a little reviving in our servitude. For we are servants, and in our servitude our God has not left us, but he extends toward us loving kindness before the kings of Persia, to give us a reviving, so as to raise up the house of our God, and to restore its desolated places, and to give us a stone wall in Judah and in Jerusalem. And now what shall we say, O our God, after this? For we have left your commandments, which you commanded by means of your servants the prophets, saying, the land that you people are going in to take possession of is an impure land because of the impurity of the peoples of the lands, because of their detestable things, with which they have filled it from end to end by their uncleanness. And now your daughters do not you people give to their sons, neither their daughters do you accept for your sons, and to time indefinite you must not work for their peace and their prosperity, in order that you may grow strong and certainly eat the good of the land, and indeed take possession of it for your sons to time indefinite. And after all that has come upon us for our bad deeds and our great guiltiness, for you yourself, O our God, have underestimated our error, and you have given us those who have escaped, such as these. Shall we go breaking your commandments again and forming marriage alliances with the peoples of these detestable things? Will you not get incensed at us to the limit, so that there will be none remaining and none escaping? O Jehovah, the God of Israel, you are righteous, because we have been left over as an escaped people, as at this day. Here we are before you in our guiltiness, for it is impossible to stand before you on account of this. And that's the end of Ezra chapter 9. Now let's go to Zechariah chapter 13. In that day, there will come to be a well open to the house of David, Zechariah writes, and to the inhabitants of Jerusalem for sin and for an abhorrent thing. And it must occur in that day as the utterance of Yahweh of armies, that I shall cut off the names of the idols out of the land, and they will no more be remembered. And also the prophets and the spirit of uncleanness I shall cause to pass out of the land. And it must occur that in case a man should prophesy any more, his father and his mother, the ones who caused his birth, must also say to him, you will not live, because falsehood is what you have spoken in the name of Jehovah. And his father and his mother, the ones who caused his birth, must pierce him through because of his prophesying. And it must occur in that day that the prophets will become ashamed, each one of his vision when he prophesies. And they will not wear an official garment of hair for the purpose of deceiving. And he will certainly say, I am no prophet, I am a man cultivating the soil, because an earthling man himself acquired me from my youth on. And one must say to him, what are these wounds on your person between your hands? And he will have to say, those with which I was struck in the house of my intense lovers. That was verse 5 and 6. Verses 5 and 6 are prophetic of the prophet and Messiah Jesus, because he had marks on his hands, wounds on his hands when he nailed him to the stake. Verse 7. O sword, awake against my shepherd, even against the able-bodied man who is my associate, is the utterance of Yahweh of armies. Strike the shepherd, and let those of the flock be scattered, and I shall certainly turn my hand back upon those who are insignificant. We know when Jesus was arrested, his disciples fled, which is also a fulfillment of that prophecy, verse 7 of Zechariah 13. Now verse 8, and it must occur in all the land is the utterance of Yahweh, that two parts in it are what will be cut off and expire. And as for the third part, it will be left remaining in it. And I shall certainly bring the third part through the fire, and I shall actually refine them as in the refining of silver, and examine them as in the examine them as in the examining of gold. It for its part will call upon my name, and I for my part will answer it. I will say, it is my people, and it in its turn will say, Jehovah is my God. That's the end of Zechariah 13. Let's see what Clark says about these things. First of all, Ezra chapter 9. The princes inform Ezra that many of the people now settled in the, in the something, now settled in the land. There's a word missing or some phrase missing there. The princes inform Ezra that many of the people now settled in the city or area of Jerusalem had married heathen wives, and several of the rulers were principal offenders in this thing. Okay, we just read that, chapter 9 of Ezra. In the Bible, we see that it's just never the case, or almost never the case, that there's a word missing. I'm going to sneeze if I don't prevent it. But in things such as secular texts, you know, or commentaries or things, any work, any writings of anybody which are transcribed by somebody, there are frequently missing words. It's not an uncommon occurrence that we find there's a missing word. Evidently, that word, well, it's missing, evidently, but whether it was missing in Clark's original commentary, we'd have to do more work to try and find that out. But many of the people now settled in the Promised Land had married heathen wives at the time of Ezra. That was the problem, because they'd been told not to do that. That even went back to, well, we can probably find that out by looking at Ezra 9. Right, let's see. See if we can find it. Right. Exodus 34 and 16. Right. Right. Yeah, it says, do not, you know, do not conclude a covenant with the inhabitants of the land, Exodus 34 and 12. And verse 16, what will happen if you do conclude a covenant? It says, then you will have to take some of their daughters for your sons, and their daughters will be certain to have immoral intercourse with their gods, and make your sons have immoral intercourse with their gods. That was why they were told not to conclude a covenant with the peoples of the Promised Land, the Amorites, Canaanites, Hittites, Perizzites, Hivites, and Jebusites, in verse 11. In Exodus 34, verse 11. So, you know, we know that was a commandment given through Moses, in the Law of Moses, in the book of Exodus. Now, we can look at Zechariah for a moment and see what Clark says about that. He says, after the humiliation and conversion of the Jews foretold in the preceding chapter, chapter 12, they are here promised the full pardon of their sins and the deliverance from idolatry and false prophets. And then prophecy concerning the death of the Messiah and the persecution of his disciples, Zechariah 13 and 7, meaning the piercing through of the hands and the scattering of the sheep from the shepherd. And the remaining verses, he says, may refer to those Jewish converts to Christianity who survived the calamities which their country suffered from the Romans. Zechariah 13, 8 and 9. Talking about bringing through the fire. One part of three. The third part would be left remaining in verse 8. Zechariah chapter 13, and bring them through the fire, verse 9, refine them as in the refining of silver, and examine them as in the examining of gold. There's so many beautiful and insightful and valuable historical bits of information in the Bible that we learn about, even things like metallurgy. We learn about things like the science of the day. Back in those times, they did have a lot more knowledge, probably, but certainly, than we give them credit for. For example, there were bolts, there were rivets in the ark, in Noah's ark, in Turkey, when they examined the petrified wood of the ark in near Uzengili in Turkey, when they found the ark. And they found these, when they looked at the rivets that they discovered were there, they did analysis of the metals, and they found that the metals used by the people who, you know, made, or what's the word for it, who did foundry work or metallurgy. The metallurgical knowledge before the flood of Noah was very advanced. They had even titanium, aluminum. They had metals in there that weren't discovered until much, much later, long after the Iron Age that followed, and the time of the Bronze Age, which was immediately following that deluge, in our chronology, which fits perfectly in our chronology, by the way. Everything fits so well in the genealogy, and the Bronze Age becomes the start of the rebirth of metallurgy after the deluge, because bronze is much easier to process and purify as a metal with a much lower heat than, for example, iron. So the Iron Age came about later, as we know from archaeological studies of digging up things. But we don't have, maybe we'll find some evidence someday of these, of the civilization before the deluge, but as far as we know, as far as I know certainly, and I've never heard of any discovery of pre-flood civilization, other than this remains of the Ark, of course. The remains of the Ark, that's why it's so valuable, because it shows that there was metallurgy before the flood, not even to mention or to barely mention the advanced design of the Ark itself with the moon pool and all of that that's discussed in the article Ark of Urartu that was studied by naval architects such as Mr. Windsor, who studied that and came away convinced that the Ark was designed by extremely knowledgeable boat builders who must have lived, as we know, from our belief that it was the Ark, that we're looking at the Ark, that, you know, these boat builders lived prior to the deluge, and Noah was in fact a boat builder in this case, but he must have learned from other boat builders, one would assume, of the time, or perhaps, of course, also he could have just been instructed by Jehovah in how to process metal and build this Ark. But then if he'd known how to process the metal, that would be no guarantee that he'd be able to recreate the same metal after the deluge, because he might not have the same available tools. All of the tools would be lacking, all of the infrastructure of the, you know, the metal processing plants and all the things that were available, all the technology that they weren't able to bring with them on the Ark would not be available after the flood. So, but maybe he just purchased the rivets from somewhere, or just, you know, maybe he didn't actually have the knowledge in how to do it. We don't know all those things. It's a remarkable thing, though, that we learn about technology from the Bible and from the study of things like the Ark, the remains of the Ark in the mountains of Ararat. And this is April 23rd, 2024 of the Common Era. The time is 1959 hours Eastern Daylight Time. Our study is concluded. I'm Ward Green. It's been a pleasure to be with you again. I love you very much. And in my behalf, this is Liv Dusty, and this is Cassie saying bye for now.